You're listening to SBS On The Money with Ricardo Gonçalves.
Hi everyone, it's Monday the 30th of June 2025. It's the end of the financial year. The Australian share market doing well on the last day, up by 0.3% on the S&P ASX 200. We'll speak with George Baburis. He's the head of research at K2 Asset Management in a few moments. He'll look back at the year that was and gives his outlook for financial year 2026. But first, the end of the financial year also means that it's tax time, and this time around the ATO is keeping a close eye on work-related expenses. That's because in 2023-24, over 9 million Aussies claimed nearly $28 billion worth, the bulk for car expenses. And it's reminding taxpayers that there are three key rules to claiming those deductions. You need to have paid for the expense yourself, it needs to directly relate to the income you're earning, and you need a record. To tell us more, I spoke with Robert Thompson, Assistant Commissioner at the Australian Taxation Office.
One of the biggest mistakes we see when it comes to work-related expenses is people just not having the right records that allows them to substantiate their claims. Now, this is important for two reasons. If you don't have the right records, you can't get the right claim. So you may be missing out on things you're entitled to claim. But the second is that if you have the right records, it makes it easier to get your tax return right the first time when you lodge.
You've got three clear tax priorities this financial year. So can we go through them? First of all, work-related expenses. Why and what do people need to know about this?
So for work-related expenses, there's three golden rules people need to follow if they're claiming a work-related expense. That is, they need to have paid for it themselves. The expense needs to directly relate to the income that they're earning. And the third is they need to have a receipt or a record to prove that. Now, the types of records you need for each type of work-related expense can differ, and there's information on the ATO website to help people there. And we also have over 40 occupational specific guidelines that help people to understand what they can and cannot claim specific to their job to make sure they're claiming everything they can, but no more.
What are some of the more unusual work-related expenses people have tried to claim but doesn't make the cut?
So, Ricardo, we've had some interesting ones. In the last year, we had a truckie that tried to claim their swimwear because it got a little bit hot on some long hauls. Obviously, while it's important that people take breaks from driving, that's obviously personal in nature. We had a mechanic that tried to claim their air fryer, TV, gaming consoles, and vacuum cleaners. Once again, this is personal in nature, not related to the income they're earning, and so they can't claim it.
Okay. Working from home deductions. More than 10 million people claimed one, and there are two ways to do that. Can you run through that?
Sure. So there's two ways. If you're working from home, there are two methods you can use. There's the fixed rate method and there's the actual cost method. You can use whichever method you want and whichever method gives you the best outcome as long as you're keeping the records to prove it. The fixed rate method allows you to claim 70 cents for every hour you work from home. But you need to make sure that you've kept a diary or a spreadsheet that outlines all the hours you've worked from home for the whole year. The actual cost method does have some additional record keeping requirements. And so the ATO website outlines what those record keeping requirements are specific to the types of costs that you might be claiming under that method.
Robert, nearly 1 million people have a second job. Many of them are from people of culturally and linguistically diverse backgrounds. These include side hustles. What do they need to know when it comes to tax time? And how do you differentiate between what is a hobby, which may not attract tax, or a job?
So, Ricardo, we know that most people do include their income from side hustles or second jobs or their employment, but we're just reminding people that if you do have a side hustle, such as earning income through a ride-sharing app or content creation, that does need to be included in your tax return. If you are undertaking activity which is persistent and repetitive for the purpose of trying to make a profit, then you might also be running a business and you need to consider the tax consequences for that as well. Like what we'd say is there's always new ways to earn income, but the tax obligations really do stay the same. Obviously, as well, there's other types of income that people need to return, including foreign employment income, pensions they might be getting from managed funds, or bank interest as well.
So we've spoken a lot about work-related expenses, right? What about other areas, investment properties, crypto, for example, cars? What are you focusing on and why?
So for investment income, we are focused on the areas where people commonly make mistakes. So on crypto is taxed like any other asset. And so just reminding people there that generally, that if you are disposing of crypto, that's considered a capital gain and or a capital loss, and you need to include that in your tax return. And there with crypto, just a reminder that you do need to keep records. So at a minimum, you should be keeping the date, time, and amount of both when you acquire and dispose of the crypto. And a reminder to people just to continue to download their transaction record every few months and make sure that they're downloading the transaction record before they close their account out. For properties, we continue to focus on areas where we commonly see property investors make mistakes. One of those is where people don't correctly apportion their expenses to take account for any private use. For example, they might use their investment loan facility for to buy a car or take the family on a holiday, or they might, while they might be renting out the property, they might also be using that property for personal use. So in those circumstances, they do need to apportion those costs between the income generating bit and the bit that relates to the personal use.
The key buzzword that everyone's using in the business world at the moment and over the past year or so is AI, right? So how is the ATO using technology, specifically AI, to data match to make sure that people are claiming what they need to claim correctly? And how easy is it for you to do so?
So the ATO uses a range of data analytics and data to identify where perhaps someone's claim just doesn't look right, and we will get in contact with them. We also use that information to try and nudge people or remind people about their tax obligations before they lodge or why they're lodging. For example, where we've got data that shows they might have disposed of a property, or where their work-related expense claim might just look a little bit higher compared to people in a similar industry. We also use a lot of that data to pre-fill into people's tax returns for them. And last year, we pre-filled over 111 million pieces of information into people's tax return for them to help them to get it right the first time they lodge.
And finally, what's the biggest tip you can offer anyone doing their own tax this year?
So the biggest tip is to make sure that you actually wait. Don't do it on 1 July. Wait until the end of July before you start to do your tax return, because we will have pre-filled a lot of information into your return for you, making it easier for you to get it right the first time. We also have guides for tax time in over 20 languages on our website that can help people to understand how they need to lodge, what they need to include, and what they can claim. The other hot tip is the ATO app. There's a lot of tools on the ATO app that allow you to understand when your pre-fill's ready to track your return, but also there's some additional security features now that allow you to lock down your account when something doesn't look right.
That's Rob Thompson there, the ATO Assistant Commissioner.
Now, Market Day on the SBS On The Money podcast.
Good day for the Australian share market. The S&P ASX 200 up 0.33% to 8,542. 10 of the 11 sectors ended in the black. Healthcare the best, followed by consumer discretionary. The material sector fell. But over the past year, today is the end of the financial year, the ASX 200 rose 10%. That's above average returns for the year. For that and more, I spoke with George Barbouris. He's the head of research at K2 Asset Management. So, George, what a year for the ASX 200, because it's up more than 10% over the financial year. How would you describe its performance in the face of a new US president? You've got geopolitical uncertainties, global tariffs, but easing inflation and interest rates too.
Well, Ricardo, as we're going into the end of fiscal year, it's been a very good performance by the equity market and also risk assets, as we call them, in other asset classes. But the reason why the equity market has been so strong, it's been that it's been reflecting reasonable economic conditions globally and reasonable earnings conditions. And at the end of the day, we're pricing future earnings. However, since January, it hasn't come without its volatility. So the markets have been much more volatile given obviously policy and regulatory commentary by the US president. So the thing for people to reinforce and what we've been advising is calendar 2025 and 26, there's going to be lots of pockets and frequent pockets of market volatility because we are pricing in future credit conditions and future earnings conditions. And when they move quickly, that's called the volatility. So in the main, there's theatre and noise from the president's commentary. But when we're looking through, there is a detraction and slowdown from global growth from the tariffs. But at the same time, there are some alternative factors that act as a cushion. That's OPEC increasing the supply of oil. That adds as a stimulus to compensate for that. And also the US have finally passed through a complicated but slightly adjusted tax cut regime to continue from that. That's an extension of the 2017 plus deregulation. So many moving parts, more volatility, but growth 1 year forward, 3 year forward. And that's what the equity markets are reflecting.
When you look at the past year, in particular the Australian market, right? What kind of assets performed well, and where's all this money coming from?
So first and foremost, Australia on the export side, resources, material, energy in general, that's at the prevailing price. So they've been able to make good consistent profits, which then turn into good tax receipts for Canberra. Hence, it's very good for the budget bottom line. That's on the export side. On the domestic demand, when you remove the export, the biggest contributor has been government at the federal and the state level, particularly on the east coast of Australia with very large infrastructure projects. They are a large proportion of the GDP domestically here. And also the very fast growing, enormous NDIS. That's such a big footprint, has to be funded from taxes and tax receipts in the future. But that's a very big footprint on the spending on the domestic economy. Very quickly, the private sector is doing it quite tough. There's a bit of a two-tier economy going here, but nevertheless, the oligopolies, as we call them, of the banking sector, the transport airline sector, and in the main have been able to have some pricing power in there, and they've been passing on some prices, particularly the supermarkets and the banks to the consumer, given they're so large. But it's a bit of a balancing act. So many moving parts, but equity markets have done reasonably well again in Australia. Other areas to look at is there's a mixed seaboard of property, obviously residential property doing quite well, particularly with the very strong migration push because of the demographic change going on in Australia. So governments in the West are obviously using that opportunity to increase it through migration because of the replacement rate. That's that narrative. So that drives long-term demand for housing and housing stock and anything in the mix along that pathway. Another very quickly area is private equity around the world tends to have had a reasonable year, but that's non-liquid, but many moving parts. But at the end of it, I'll finish off where I started. Equity markets are reflecting reasonable earnings conditions and more reasonable and promising versus expectation. And that's the key here.
If you remember a few months ago when the market fell quite dramatically following Donald Trump's Liberation Day tariffs, a lot of the headlines are not just about the market falling, but superannuation funds taking a big hit, right? Now that the market seems to have recovered, it's up 10% for the year in term, when we talk about the local share market anyway. What do you think this now means for super?
It's the same. The headlines around the Trump tariff announcements in early April, we overgeneralize and say it's a lot of theatre and noise. Because what's the probability of those tariffs that are announced to be continued for the years to come? It's probable but highly unlikely that that will happen. So we call it theatre and noise, and look for what the hard data changes are. What's going to happen to the economic data and economic profile? Because, Ricardo, the survey data, or what we call soft data, is quite weak. But in the last 6 months, particularly a year even, the indicators from the survey data has been quite weak. It hasn't followed through with very weak economic data. That's a thing to reinforce. So when we take a step back, we call it theatre and noise. You've got to invest through the cycle. So when we go to a pension scheme or the industry super funds in Australia or a sovereign wealth fund from around the world or pensions in the Northern Hemisphere, they're invested or nearly fully invested through the cycle. That means they're invested for 20, 30, 40 years, depending on where you are in your life cycle. They're not buying and selling like the headlines are suggesting they are. So in the main, you generally, from a behavioural point of view, is look through what's the chance of the hard data, economic data, really been downgraded severely, and the World Bank, the IMF and the World Bank lowered their GDP forecast. But in the main, we are buying future earnings, we are estimating future credit conditions, and economies are growing more and expanding more than contracting. Therefore, earnings expand more than contract. Therefore, on average, pension funds and your industry super fund would have done reasonably well this fiscal year, very well, and probably do reasonably well in the next fiscal year.
Okay, so speaking of that next fiscal year, what's your outlook for FY26 when it comes to the markets? How do you see it panning out? And what do you see as the biggest market moving events?
Yeah, great question. So we see the equity market positive 1 year forward on the following premise. The government still has got a large footprint spend with NDIS. Exports continue to contribute to the bottom line and therefore tax receipts for Canberra. But this is the most important element. That's the Reserve Bank of Australia. The Reserve Bank of Australia made it very clear from the May rate cut that when they cut rates in Australia in May, that they lowered both the core CPI and also their GDP forecast to make accommodative language and to reassure the market that they want more rate cuts going forward than less. This is the opposite to the US. The US has got a much lower core CPI outlook, but they won't be cutting rates in a hurry and given no guidance to do so. But in Australia, the Reserve Bank governor has basically given the local equity market an insurance policy and the local housing market an insurance policy. We call that a put. So if they don't deliver with another three or four rate cuts, that will be a negative for the equity market in Australia because they made it very clear that they are accommodative. That means that the Reserve Bank of Australia have gone out of the way to lower the forecast to meet their expectations to create a pathway for lower cash rates going forward. And that's quite rare for the RBA to be that specific. Therefore, the equity market likes that news and has rallied into 30 June in anticipation. And next fiscal year, it requires those rate cuts from the RBA as they flagged and promised. To be able to drive those earnings higher than average.
And finally, so assuming the market moves along as you expect it to in the new year, that the Reserve Bank does cut three or four more times, where do you see the opportunities for investors?
If the RBA are true to their label and lower their forecast to make it accommodative and lower interest rate, equity markets, housing would do quite well out of that, and some property funds can recover. Some private equity and some corporate bonds would do okay in that. That's to reinforce. But remember, if the RBA doesn't deliver all of those or give signs that they won't, that's when the market will be a little bit weaker. The other thing to overlay that with globally and domestically, more frequent pockets of volatility are with us for a number of years now. Just be conditioned for it and look at your portfolio, how it's positioned. More, normally, your portfolio across all the asset classes is positioned for 10, 20, 30, 40 years. It's fully invested, but that's what you'd be looking at. More pockets of frequent volatility in the year ahead. But the RBA has made it very, very clear to Australia and to corporate Australia, we're going to be accommodative, lower rates. If they don't deliver that, I think we have some weakness in the market.
That is George Baburis there from K2 Asset Management. Don't forget, if you enjoy the podcast, to give it a rating or review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, and to click that subscribe button.
This SBS On The Money stream is provided for informational purposes only. The content in this stream should not be understood as constituting advice or a recommendation. It is not personal advice and it does not consider your personal circumstances or objectives. You should contact a licensed professional before making any financial decision. This SBS On The Money podcast is provided for informational purposes only. The content on this podcast should not be understood as constituting advice or a recommendation. It is not personal advice and does not consider your personal circumstances or objectives. You should contact a licensed professional before making any financial decision.